Let's turn in the scriptures to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is an Old Testament wisdom book. And this summer, especially throughout the next 2 months, I'm burdened to teach the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. I'm wanting those of you who are not followers of Jesus, I'm wanting to compel you to commit your lives to him. Those of you who are followers of Jesus, I am wanting to help you grow in maturity. Ecclesiastes is a wonderful book for maturity. It's actually a painful book to consider. Ecclesiastes is painful. It's sort of like going to the chiropractor. If you're not experiencing tension and pain, it's probably because nothing's happening. An effective visit is going to have times where you say, ow! An effective reading of Ecclesiastes is going to have multiple times where you say, ow. It's a painful book. Why am I burdened to teach it right now? Why am I burdened to teach Ecclesiastes? Well, we experience the power of this book in a couple smaller groups. Teens, Sunday night study. I led a midweek study with about 25 people 3 years ago. Ladies, Bible study has considered Ecclesiastes. But I've been burdened for at least the last 6 months to teach Ecclesiastes because it's been so life-changing. And even those smaller groups within the congregation have considered it. I think our entire congregation would benefit from considering Ecclesiastes. The message of this book, I think it's safe to say, now affects me almost daily. I've experienced something of its power. In the months after the study I led in 2016, at least 5 people approached me, and they told me that it was life-changing for them. Like they said, I can't think about life the same. I want to take the summertime, and I want us to consider the uncomfortable, the painful, but critical question that Ecclesiastes keeps forcing us to ask and answer. The question that Ecclesiastes is asking is this: what gives meaning to your life? What makes your life worth living? The ruins of Rhuthlin Castle stand in North Wales. It was built by King Edward I of England around 1280, so about 650 years ago. It was one of the strong fortresses he built to suppress the Welsh rebellion in the western side of his empire. Rhuthlin was one castle of at least 8 that he built in the region. Some have estimated that King Edward I invested, at least of our dollars, $40 million in these construction projects. It was enormous. But his investment ended up paying off. After building these fortresses and manning these fortresses with thousands of soldiers, over 2 decades, he suppressed the Welsh rebellion that was led by Llywelyn II. He suppressed it, and he became ruler over Wales. So he not only finished his over 30-year reign with greater power, but he also left incredible architecture behind. One Welsh historian, mind you, says Edward has left Wales with a legacy of medieval military architecture. It's of truly international importance. You don't have to answer out loud. I'm not asking you to talk out. I'm not asking you to raise your hands. But how many of you hadn't even heard of Edward before today? How many of you if I said, when did Edward I live and reign? How many of you would have known that he reigned in the latter portion of the 1200s? How many of you, after hearing about his, quote, legacy of medieval military architecture of truly international importance, after hearing about that important, internationally important legacy of architecture, how many of you would be willing to spend, say, $1,000 of your money in a few days of your life and go over and explore the 8 castles? How many of you, let's back it down, how many of you are so interested in this internationally significant builder that you're like wanting to go to the library and check out a book, maybe the definitive history of Edward I, and you devote maybe 8 or 10 hours of your life to reading about this man of international significance? My guess is that very few of us would be so impressed with Edward's legacy that we'd spend a few $100 and a couple days of our lives to go check it out. My guess is that very few of us actually knew about Edward and when he lived and what he did and who he was warring against. I would guess that very few of us would actually know about Rithlin if it weren't for the fact that we have awesome gospel partners, Steve and Marcia, in Rithlin, who we pray for regularly. They are doing the incredibly hard work of church planting through church revitalization in Rithlin. My guess is that this city wouldn't even be a blip on our radar, even though it houses a castle of medieval military architecture of truly international importance. The reason I bring up Edward and Rithlin is to make us think about this question: what gives meaning to life? Does leaving an enduring legacy give your life meaning? Does leaving an enduring legacy give your life meaning? Edward was a really important man in history. His name, it can be found in history books. He left his mark on the British landscape. He left his mark on the British tourism industry. Do you think that any of those accomplishments made his life worth living? He left a legacy of truly international importance. Think that made his life worth living? What gives your life meaning? I want us to see how Solomon answers that question. I've asked you to turn to Ecclesiastes 1. We're going to first see Ecclesiastes 1, how Solomon answers the question in a negative way, and this is going to be a painful way. Okay? Next couple minutes, watch out. It's going to be painful. And then we're going to flip to the end of the book, and we're going to look at how he answers the question in a positive way. Ecclesiastes 1, starting in verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's his thesis for the whole book. That's his main point throughout this entire book of Ecclesiastes. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down, and it hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits, the wind returns. All streams run into the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they go again, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. I can't even begin to talk about it. I mean, the eye isn't satisfied with seeing. The ear isn't filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Really, is there a thing of which it said, see, this is really new? It has already been in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out wisdom, to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And let me tell you, it's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be occupied with. I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, striving after wind. What's crooked can't be made straight, and what's lacking can't be counted. That's where we'll end our reading. Keep your eye on the text, and I just want to walk through a couple statements so you get exactly what Solomon's saying. He introduces himself in verse 1, then, like I said, he states his main point in verse 2. To say vanity of vanities is to say, like, the greatest of all emptinesses. He's basically saying something like this: I cannot begin to express how utterly pointless life seems. In verse 3, he then asks the question that was on the title slide. Have you ever stopped to consider what people actually achieve by all the stressful activity they engage in? I mean, life is full of activity. It's full of work and toil. What do people actually gain by it? That's his question, and it is a painful question to consider. He answers it, actually, with beautiful illustrations from the natural world. So in verse 4, he's going to say, do you realize that generations just keep coming and going? The earth just keeps on spinning, and people keep being born and dying. Verse 5, the sun just keeps on rising and setting. Verse 6, the weather patterns just keep on changing and the seasons just keep on cycling. Verse 7, to put it in our language, the Grand River, it just keeps flowing into Lake Erie. Lake Erie's never full. And he basically implies the hydraulic cycle, elementary school science kids. The hydraulic cycle is implied here in verse 7. It's basically saying somehow the water that goes to the sea is going to end up getting rained down and collected into the rivers again. Verse 8, he just stops and he says, do you see why I'm so frustrated? He says, when I consider how much activity is going on without any real progress, it's just disturbing. Verse 9, he says, things don't really change. There's no substantial progress on earth, nothing that shows real progress for humanity. And his point in verse 11, get a load of this one. Feel this prod. No society really remembers and values the contributions of previous generations. So Solomon wraps up his introductory observations in verses 12 to 15. He basically says, see, I devoted myself to trying to explain what life's all about. I wanted to try to state an approach to life, a philosophy of life, that kind of makes sense of everything, that gives meaning to my life and what I do. But let me just say, this is a miserable task. Trying to find a satisfying explanation for life's meaning is a miserable job that God's given us to do. From the look of all the activity, everything just seems utterly pointless. Solomon says, you're just left with a lot of wrongs that can't be righted and with a lot of problems that aren't able to be fixed. So the wise King Solomon's search for life meaning begins with a poem about how, I'm quoting one scholar, Dwayne Garrett, he says, The universe, like us, is forever moving but accomplishing nothing. Is that painful to you? It's been a hard year, hasn't it? Some of you have sweat a whole lot. Some of you have stayed up a lot of sleepless nights. How does it feel to be told you are forever active, but really accomplishing nothing? So, what is the bottom line profit of a lifetime of hard work? Well, you're going to have a name that your children know and your grandchildren know. And your great-grandchildren might be able to remember. And your great-grandchildren, they'll never even think about your name. Or you're going to be like Edward. You're going to have a name that is so stinking significant that people are going to hate you because they had to memorize your name for history of civilization, and they could never get the right name with the right date. It's been said, the vast majority of people never achieve lasting fame, while those who do gain nothing by it. So what makes all of your life effort meaningful? What makes it meaningful? Here is stage one, main point of Ecclesiastes 1. Stage one of having a wise outlook on life is coming to terms with this painful reality. My life is not going to make a big difference. Making a difference in the world or leaving a legacy isn't what gives life meaning. You see, it's a negative thing. What gives life meaning? It's not making a difference or leaving a legacy. Solomon's main point in Ecclesiastes 1 is, you can kiss that hope goodbye. I wonder, are you experiencing the pain of the book? If you're experiencing pain right now, you're in the middle of a chiropractic adjustment that's going to be helpful. It's a good thing. Sometimes when you start reading a book and the first chapter ends on a cliffhanger, you like immediately flip to the back of the book. You're like, I am not going to be able to endure the suspense. How's this thing going to end? So rather than leaving you here and leaving all of us here with only a negative understanding, I want to ask you to flip over to Ecclesiastes 12, and I'm going to talk about the thing that gives life meaning. What is it that makes life worth living? If it's not making a difference and leaving a legacy, what is it? Here's the grand conclusion of the book, Ecclesiastes 12, 8 through 14. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. You can see he comes back to his main point. What he's saying is from everything you can see, life with all of its stresses and activities and pains and pleasures seems utterly pointless. And then he concludes very objectively. Notice how he actually steps into the third person. And he says, I've taken you through this whole exploration of emptiness. Now let me step back and let me tell you the significance of it all. Verse 9. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. That might seem strange to you, but notice what's being said right after the final, you might say the grand explanation. Everything seems so pointless. The next verses say, this guy knows exactly what he's doing. He knows how to teach people wisdom. He knows how to lead people down a course of thinking that is right and compelling. He knows exactly what he's been doing. Verse 11, the words of the wise are like goads. They're like nails firmly fixed. Goads. Do you know what a goad is? A goad isn't an instrument. It's basically a spear that you prod an animal with. What you're being told is Ecclesiastes is filled with goads to get you and me moving. And then we're told it's like nails. Nails fasten things together. They fasten things together so that they're really hard to pull apart. But I would guess that if your brain were likened to a board, experiencing a nail is going to be an uncomfortable thing. Just like experiencing a goad is painful, experiencing a nail. But what we're being told is the manner in which Solomon is communicating this truth to us has a way of fixing these things to our lives like nails put boards together. This guy's an effective teacher. And then notice where all these words come from. This is one of the clearest statements that an author was writing under inspiration of God in the scriptures. All these words that are like goads and like nails, they're all given by one shepherd. These are given by the Lord. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end. And much study is a weariness of the flesh. What Solomon is telling his son and those in his court is that this book that he's written is really sufficient for developing a philosophy of life. You can try to read and take courses in philosophy, but what I've given you is sufficient. Here's the end of the matter, verse 13. Everything's been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. This is what it means to be human. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. See, life is not about making a difference, leaving your mark. Life is about God. You exist for God. What gives meaning to your life is not how much of a difference you make. It's not how much you accomplish. It's not how many people you touch. It's about living for God, period. That's what you were made to do. You were made to live for God. Searching for life's significance outside a relationship with God is pointless. So if you're a mom, do you know that the worth of your life doesn't depend on whether or not you have kids? Doesn't depend on whether or not your kids turn out like you want them to turn out? What gives your life significance is that you walk with God as a mom, and that you're faithful to your God-given responsibilities as a mom. What gives your life meaning is not the legacy you leave. It's who you relate with while you live. If you're a doctor, what gives your life meaning isn't how many people you help. It isn't how successful your practice is. Even if you help lots of people, you know that eventually you are going to die and all the people you're serving are going to die. Even if your practice becomes really successful and maybe you open up multiple practices and they all bear your last name, you know, It's going to be bought by someone else. And eventually, your last name is going to be relegated to historical interest. Who is this named after? Maybe you'll get a plaque on the wall. Now, if you're a doctor, the only thing that can give your life significance is if you personally know God. If you do your work as unto God. If you live faithfully for God. Life is not about leaving a legacy. You were made to live for God, to faithfully know Him and walk with Him and serve Him, whether you're successful or not. You're made for God. Fearing God is Old Testament language for having a relationship with Him, having a personal relationship with Him. These things that we often live for, like, I'm living to make a difference, they're really just an illusion. We're made for God. We're not made for life apart from Him. To fear Him is what we're made for. Look again at those verses 13 and 14. This is the point of life. This is what gives life meaning. You ready? Fear God. Keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. This is what it means to be human. For God will bring every deed into judgment. Do you know that the only way you can obey these commands is through Jesus? There is no hope of you doing this on your own. How do you fear God? How do you have a personal relationship with God? There's one way. It's through Jesus. You cannot relate to God on the basis of your good works. No chance that you're a good enough person to outweigh your rebellion. The only way you can come to God is through Jesus. It's the only way. It's the narrow way. Only Jesus can empower you to obey. He actually can change your heart. He can cleanse your heart from sin, renovate your heart so that, as the scripture says, you're given a new heart, one that wants to obey. And then He puts His Spirit in you to compel you to obey God's commands. You can actually, truly, and increasingly obey God as a follower of Jesus. And finally, it's only Jesus who can make you ready for judgment. In fact, the way Jude ends, the second to last book of the Bible, Jude says, Jesus has the power to present you faultless before the throne of God with exceeding joy. How are you going to stand before God when He brings everything you've ever done into judgment? If you think, I hope my good outweighs my bad, you're hopeless. Only Jesus can make you stand before God on the day when you will give an account for everything you've done. If you're not a follower of Jesus, you can't understand the point of life. And I urge you to commit your life to King Jesus, who died in your place, who rose again, who's coming again. I urge you to commit your life to Him. It's the only way to discover the purpose of life. Just before I conclude, I want to highlight one more crucial way in which the study of Ecclesiastes points to Jesus. I've pointed these three ways from chapter 12. Let me just point the central way chapter 1 points to Jesus. Remember in chapter 1, Solomon said the world is just full of activity, but it never results in any meaningful progress? That's true for every human except one. None of us, not one of us, can lastingly change the world or fix the world's problems. To think that we can means that we have what's sometimes called in secular psychology textbooks a Messiah complex. Do you have a Messiah complex? You think that you can fix every problem? The weight of the world hangs on you? No. There's only one person who can fix the world's problems, and that's Jesus. He demonstrated in his first coming that he can conquer disease, that he can change the weather. He demonstrated in his first coming that he can raise the dead, remake the heart, remake the world. And Jesus alone demonstrated that he has the power and the wisdom to fix the world, which he will do when he returns. Come, Lord Jesus. You see, Christian, God doesn't call you to be someone significant. He calls you to love the someone who is significant. He calls you to live for Christ, work for Christ, to know Christ, to delight in Christ, to cast your cares on Christ. He wants you to live knowing the name that's above every name. We sing with Mark Hall, I don't want to leave a legacy. I don't care if they remember me, only Jesus. I don't want to leave a legacy. I don't care if they remember me, only Jesus. His is the name worth living for. His is the name worth remembering. His is the name that matters. And our lives only find significance when we do our work at home or outside the home for Jesus. Only Jesus can reconcile you with God. Only Jesus can compel you to obey God's commands. Only Jesus can make you ready for judgment. And only Jesus can change the world. A few years ago, my family spent a few days of vacation with relatives on the coast of North Carolina. One evening, as the sun was setting, all of us went out to Wrightsville Beach, and we played at the ocean. I love the ocean. That night, I spent over an hour building a sandcastle. It was a replica of Rifflin Castle with my son and my niece. We had so much fun. What made that hour valuable? Well, I build things that last. Next time I go to Wrightsville Beach, I'm going to look for our sandcastle. Because I built it to last. Do you see how tough those towers are? See, the sandcastle isn't going to be there when I go back. I doubt that it made it even 24 hours. The tides and the winds and the rain, they make quick work of it. So why did we build the sandcastle? Why did we waste so much time on something that wouldn't last? Something that wouldn't make any contribution to the beach landscape. For me, it was just the joy of being with these two kids. For them, it was just the joy of being creative and building something with Daddy and Uncle Joe. It wasn't about leaving anything enduring. It was about relationship. You get the point? That's the main point Solomon's making in Ecclesiastes. There's really very little difference between Edward's Rifflin Castle and my sandcastle at Wrightsville Beach. My work might last a few hours and his might last a few centuries, but what he did doesn't give his life significance, and what I did doesn't give the work significance. The thing that gives our lives significance, the only thing that gives our lives significance, is that we're doing it. We're living for the Lord. It's not what we're doing that's so significant. It's who we're doing it for that makes life significant. Do you experience the pain of Ecclesiastes 1? I hope you come out saying, I've been through a spiritual chiropractic adjustment today. I hope once you experience the pain of being told what you do doesn't make a big difference. Your name's not going to be remembered by your great-grandchildren. If it is, it's going to be in a history book, and it's going to be a painful memory because they have to memorize it for history of civ. Is it painful to come to that realization? Yes, but it is wonderfully freeing. Do you know that no matter how tomorrow turns out, if you're living for Jesus, if you're doing your work as unto him, you can end the day with a sense of thankfulness and joy for any good that you enjoyed in it, and the greatest good that you enjoyed in it, which is knowing Jesus. That's what you're made for. That's the way you're made to live.